This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on today's episode, I'm chatting with Hoagy Bix Carmichael, Tony nominee Susan H. Schulman, and Michael Lichtenfeld. If you think you don't know Hoagy Carmichael's music, you probably do. Anyone who has beat out Heart and Soul on the piano, fallen in love with the soundtrack to Sleepless in Seattle, or can remember Ray Charles singing Georgia on My Mind is familiar with Carmichael's songs. In fact, he wrote hundreds of songs, collaborated with lots of other artists like Frank Lesser and Johnny Mercer, and was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame and the Hollywood Walk of Fame. His song Stardust has been recorded over 2,000 times and was selected for inclusion in the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress in 2004. For the last 6 years, Carmichael's son Hoagy Bix, along with Tony-nominated director Susan H. Schulman and choreographer Michael Lichtenfeld, have been developing a new musical featuring songs from Carmichael's catalog. The show is making its world premiere here in Sanford, North Carolina, a far cry from Carmichael's beloved home of Bloomington, Indiana. And that's where my conversation with Lichtenfeld, Schulman, and Hoagy Bix begins.
Dad was forever a guy from Indiana. I've said this before. Forever until he died, his phone number was in the phone book. We went to restaurants. We never sat in a private space. He didn't need that, really. He was a little like his music, all about the flow. Somebody was asking me a couple of days ago, four times, I think, I remember driving along with Dad, and he would stop and write a song idea on the hood of the car. If I may use the word genius, if he wasn't a genius, he was close to it, and as a lot of these guys were.
So in talking about this musical, Stardust Road, how do you pick what songs to use out of this vast catalog of music?
It's a blessing and a curse. It really is. It's a blessing because you have so much to choose from, and it's a curse because you have so much to choose from. When Hoagy called me about this project, I didn't know the catalog, and I think my response was, I knew the obvious songs, right? And I said, well, let me take a look at it and see if I
that.
Thought, I mean, I was really sort of, really? Let me look at the catalog and see if there's something theatrical we can find here. And when I went in to look at it, I was like, oh my goodness. And it's a song that I've known my whole life. Again, I had no idea he had written. And then when we went further, it was like Pandora's box. But one of the things we came up with rather soon was the four decades in which he wrote, which was the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. So those decades were clear to us, and his music evolved over those decades, and that's part of the thing we're trying to show here, as well as the relationships evolving, that his music became more sophisticated, more complex, more internal, as far as the emotionality of it goes, and that's part of what moves our story forward as well.
As Susan was saying, the music gets more sophisticated as when ragtime is kind of where we start. And as the choreographer, it gave me a chance to choreograph four different decades of dance, which helps not only set tone, but set period. Because what better way than with movement to show how it evolved, how we evolved.
And one thing interesting, I have a new favorite song of Dad's, a song I did not know existed 4 years ago, called The World of No Goodbyes. And it was written in 1944, World War II song, about, you kiss them goodbye, they go off, and who knows where they come back.
And what's interesting, you have no idea how big the catalog is, or maybe you do if you look, but you know, when I went looking for stuff, you know, I like went, oh my stars, you know, and we did. We found the world of No Goodbyes, and he like went, what is that song? And the title caught my eye, and I like went, oh, the world of No Goodbyes. Let's listen to it and see. And you know, you have to go to Spotify and YouTube and everywhere possible to try and get a to hear what it is. But the library at IU was incredibly helpful to us because we could go and check stuff out. And not only do they have Hoagy's music there, but they also have handwritten lyrics.
Old-fashioned lead sheets, yeah. At least.
Which, you know, help us say, okay, the lyrics of this song are pertinent to the position, to the plot that we're having here. Mm-hmm. But there was a song that he had not heard as of yesterday called Sitting in Whitland. Mm-hmm. And it's just an old-time, toe-tapping, ragtime piece that we get to show off our live band, which is really exciting for us. And they just wail on it. Larry Yerman, who's not here with us, he's done an extraordinary work on this show, and I think all of us will agree that his contribution to the show is immeasurable.
It's quite a feat to keep something in period, but keep it modern, mm-hmm. but give it a modern twist. And a part of what we try to do is take songs that were written, most of them are written as pop tunes. They were not written in context of storytelling, right? So we're trying to give them a storytelling context, meaning a beginning, a middle, and then a journey. And I have to compliment our performers, and Larry, of course, because they've been able to take these songs and suddenly they're character tunes and they're plot songs, and you see them, the performers going through a journey and having a revelation and all these things. So they stand as theater songs, which just goes to prove how talented he was.
And let me just quickly interject, because Dad almost never wrote for somebody or for something. Mm-hmm. So it definitely was not written for it. The song for a story. Right. Oh, no, absolutely not.
We've got a relatively young cast performing these, because we made the decision early on to have young people doing old-time songs to see what they bring to it.
Intrinsically,
And I think the thing that's astounding to this cast, and even in the workshops that we've done prior to this, is how everybody relates to this music. They all mm-hmm. went, oh my gosh, this stuff is so beautiful, which it is, but it's unknown to them at the auditions. You know, who doesn't know who Hoagy Carmichael is in all these hands?
Yeah.
It's sad, but the revelation to them of that, you know, Georgia on My Mind
was not written by Ray Charles.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
exactly. And I think they've all kind of taken this music to heart and have embraced, you know, what we're trying to do with it.
Had he written for the stage?
Once.
I Walk With Music. Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics, and, you know, they played the Barrymore for, I think, 43 performances.
Actually, a lot of that music is in our show. We found the songs and like went these. Mm-hmm. Well, I Walk With Music, which mm-hmm. is one of the final numbers of the show, is and the title of the show that didn't last. It's so gripping, and you know, like, how did this show with this kind of music
in
it? How did it not work? I'm curious as to. I'd love to read the show.
The book, right?
I'd love to read the book and just go. Okay, well, what
happened?
What happened? What didn't work? All composers have shows that, you know, Irving Berlin had shows that flopped. So, I mean, it's not that unusual. But something went wrong because the music that we've heard from the show is all pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
One thing that surprised me about your dad, which I didn't actually know, is that he went to law school. Did he not think music was a viable profession? It was money, right?
Well, it was make a living. And when he was down in Palm Beach, at one point, even in my youth, a record store would almost always play music that you could hear out on the street. And Dad was walking along that street and he heard, wait a minute, they're playing Washboard Blues. Red Nichols and the Five Pennies are playing my song. It's on a record. And within them, both sides were him. That was the moment where Dad said, I'm out of here.
Not going to be a lawyer.
Well, they like my stuff. They play my stuff. I don't even know it. Who made the deal for me? I don't know.
Well, those days, it was really horrifying the way how writers did not get compensated for the use of their music. I mean, that took such a long time and a lot of negotiation to get that done. Even today, it's hard to explain to young people why they have to pay to use a song.
Jelly Roll Morton used to star at the top of 22nd Street, which was Tim Panelli.
Right.
And he would make a deal with four or five of them, knowing he was never going to get paid by most of them.
Well, and in your life, in your career, you have had a bond with other children of famous songwriters, Mary Rodgers. I know you set up an organization with Mary.
Amsong.
To protect the legacy of this music and to protect the copyright.
What you haven't said is that we were working to extend the term of copyright 20 years. That's important. Because you have songs like Stardust. Stardust now would be out of copyright. So would Georgia. And there was a groundswell of not just people in the music business, but Penn, the writers, and the movie industry very much. In fact, Michael Eisner is the guy that cemented the deal. He went to Washington, had dinner with Clinton, and he said, Mickey Mouse is going out of copyright soon. Same year as Stardust, 1927. And Clinton said, all right, that's all I need to hear.
So can you tell me about your dad's relationship with Bix Beiderbecke, your middle namesake?
Well, Dad was going to Indiana, trying to get a law degree. He had to make some money. He was booking bands in, and had his own band, the wonderful theater, Indiana Theater. And he booked the Wolverines. Bix was in the Wolverines. He knew about Bix. He never met Bix. When they met, maybe the second time, I'm not sure, after the gig, Bix said, hey, I hear you can get some music in you. And Dad sat down and played some stuff for Bix. And in 4 months, they were down in Richmond, Indiana, recording. Mm-hmm. And for my father, I mean, that's, you know, catching a pass from Eli Manning or something, or Sandy Koufax. I mean, what? So it was a mentorship that started just that way.
Did your dad have any regrets?
Here's what Dad's regret was. Dad knew how to arrange music, write music, and he knew about lyrics. He just did. And my father redlined Johnny Mercer, and he redlined Ned Washington, and he redlined everybody. And he came back with arguably a better idea. And Dad did regret that he was not a kinder and gentler soul artistically with some of the writers that he worked with. That, I heard Dad say that.
Did he have a favorite song?
Well, it's not in the show. Yes, he has a song that he loved called One Morning in May. One morning in May. Dad, I love that song. He also liked Stardust because it hit him on the hip. Made some money there.
It was, it was recorded 1,500 times, so.
Oh, no, 2,300.
2,300.
A woman called me 10 years ago and said, my husband had one hobby and one hobby only, and that was collecting versions of Stardust. She said, I don't have them all, but I have 1,600. So she sent them to me, and they're at Indiana.
Do you guys have a favorite song in the show?
Oh, I do, just The Shade on the Blue Side.
How Little We Know. There's something about that song that just touches me every time I hear it. It's so true.
Well,
it
and
is
it's
so
a,
true.
It's a Beguine. Yeah. Who knew that Hoagy Carmichael wrote a Beguine? Cole Porter's the only person that wrote a Beguine.
Right.
And we listened to it, and I like when there are two of them, that and Ivy, which are both Beguine rhythms.
How has the show changed in 6 years? I know you've been working on it a while.
Way, way back when we first started with it was just kind of showing the evolution of the music and how it evolved up
people
to
no,
Hollywood.
No real relationships throughout.
But last year when we went to Indiana, relationships started to develop and, and characters started to develop. And that kind of happened last year, and even more so here, because of the actress, and because we had the opportunity, Peggy Tappan, God bless her,
Peggy and the Temple,
Theater for giving us this opportunity to hone it and to continue working on it.
You can be in a studio for the rest of your life, and you'll never find out what you find out by sitting out there and watching something like
this. You know, you have to realize
it reveals itself.
We've never seen it with a band. Mm-hmm. We've never seen it on stage. We've never seen it in costume. We've never seen it with sound. Mm-hmm. This is a new beginning for us on it.
We had an interesting thing happen because I went to London and made a deal with Cameron McIntosh's brother, Robert. And we went over there, and we cast the show, and we had arrangements and all that. That was another show, really. It's this show, but it's another show. And Michael and I were talking about that last night. It's a good darn thing we didn't go through.
That it didn't happen. It didn't go through because it wasn't ready.
No, it wasn't
ready. Well, and we didn't really know that at the time. Now we know it.
No, I firmly believe that Hoagie's looking down on us and going, not that one, this one.
Right.
You know, I think, and I believe it. And because the show changed dramatically from when we were going to do it.
What we would have done in London,
And who knows, had we done it there, it could have been the end.
What is it about these old songs that still speak to us today?
Everybody can relate to the emotion. There is what we used to call a hook in the good old days, you know, where a song would start and you go, okay, there's a melodic hook and there's a structure to it that makes some sort of musical sense, which carries the emotion to a place of release, and people take that journey, they take that musical journey. Songs are not constructed that way by and large today. And it's that kind of classical construction that still holds true no matter what.
It's interesting because much of the music, dad's music, was originally jazz-driven. I remember, I don't think Michael and Susan have heard this, but they had to move to Missoula, Montana, because his father needed to find some job. And I went to the house with dad when dad was making a picture out there, and it's a little house and all that, and the railroad tracks are from here to the door. And behind that was a row of brick houses, probably 20, all connected. And Dad said, oh, yeah. He said, that's where the whorehouses were in town. And there were also black musicians in almost every one of them playing ragtime and early jazz. And he said, I went down there and listened. And that stuff went in one ear and stayed there. So, you know, whether my father liked it or not, he was immersed.
Now, your dad, I mean, we're talking 40 years of music just as a snapshot in this particular musical, did he ever talk to you about how the music industry had changed?
You have no idea. My father was really, really saddened and believed very strongly that his music was, if not dead, soon to die. He ended up collecting coins. He ended up playing a lot more golf. There was no avenue for his music. The Jefferson Airplane was making all the money. And my father died thinking that his work had a life and it was over.
What do you think Hoagie would say about having a whole show like this?
Please, you're going to make me cry because I really wish you were here to see this because It would erase, to some extent, those feelings he had for 12, 15 years before he died.
It's a terrible feeling to think that you've been left behind, that what you've contributed is no longer relevant.
I think one thing that we're trying to do with this particular piece is remind an audience of Hoagie Carmichael's legacy for people that may not know it.
I want to remind you that Stardust Road is now playing through November 3rd at Temple Theater in Sanford. More information on the production, along with a transcript of this interview, can be found in the episode notes. I've also put together a Spotify playlist featuring some of my favorite Hoagy Carmichael songs, and I'll be sharing that on our social media pages at RDU on Stage. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast, become a patron of RDU on Stage, or visit our website at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.